35 years ago. Oxford, Massachusetts. December 19, 1754. Ephraim ducked. The jug missed him by a foot and shattered against the doorframe, filling the room with an overpowering scent of fermented apples.
"It is his right, Mr. Moore," Joseph North said, stepping between my father and my husband.
That word, husband, so new I couldn't yet speak it aloud. The mere thought was startling enough.
"They are married now," he continued, lifting the certificate in one hand as though to offer proof.
As town clerk, North had the legal right to marry us, a fact Ephraim had known and exploited.
"I care nothing of his rights. It's my daughter's reputation that concerns me."
"There's nothing left of it, Father. Billy Crane saw to that." They were startled to hear me speak, and every head in the room turned. I had remained silent that evening, speaking only when my turn came to say the vows. "I have forsaken all others and will cleave only unto thee." The words were still warm on my lips, and I pressed them together, hoping to keep the sensation intact. For those few moments, I was not afraid, was not ashamed. My mother had been crying for over an hour. Father alternately in rage and puffing with relief that his disgraced daughter had been redeemed. North came as promised, arriving shortly after we did, documents in order. Ephraim held my hand as we walked through the door and refused to let me leave his side even for a moment.
"Billy Crane is dead," North said.
Father nodded, crossed his arms over his chest.
"And I do thank you for that."
"And Martha comes with me,"
Ephraim said firmly, drawing the conversation back to the topic at hand.
"We go to housekeeping tonight."
Most couples, my parents included, did not begin living together for many months after the wedding, choosing instead to consummate but live separately until a house could be put in proper order. Tradition held that this was a way to gather all the necessary goods needed to keep a home. It also gave the groom time to complete living arrangements for the new couple. But in fact, the practice was often used by parents to ensure that their daughter had not made a grievous mistake in her choice of husband. Though not common, it was not unheard of for an annulment to be requested in the weeks after a wedding.
"She has nothing," my mother wailed.
"She has me, and I have plenty to get us started,"
Ephraim said.
"Hasn't enough been taken from her? Do you mean to withhold tradition as well?"
He referred to the communal gathering and gifting of household goods, dishes and linens and quilts, that usually took place after a wedding and before newly married couples made a home together. He wanted to make sure that the women of our community would still make me a wedding quilt. He wanted to make sure the town would not shame me.
"If this is her choice, she can do without," my father said. And even though I could tell he regretted the words as soon as he spoke them, he lifted his chin in defiance. "I am saddened to hear you say that, Mr. Moore. I had thought better of you."
Ephraim released my hand and moved his arm to my waist. He pulled me tight against his side.
"You can send her trunk in the morning, but she comes with me tonight."
The cabin was bigger than I expected. Two rooms, the larger with a stacked stone fireplace. In one corner there was a kitchen with a cook stove, a table, and a window above a long stretch of rough-hewn wooden counter. A bedroom. I glanced at the door, looked away, glanced back. My hands began to shake. Ephraim released me and stepped away.
"Do you like it?"
"I love the home, and I love the man. And I didn't have the proper words to tell him either of those things. I hadn't answered his question, though, so I turned to him, nodding. "I do."
He noted the pleasure in my eyes and ducked his head with a bashful smile. "Say that again. I like the sound of it."
Our vows. He had grinned his way through them, beaming as if we were the only two people in my parents' kitchen earlier that evening, as if the room weren't crackling with tension. I didn't realize I was shivering until Ephraim bent to light a fire in the hearth. Once it was crackling merrily and the bitter chill had been chased from the room, he went into the bedroom to light another fire in the hearth there. He returned, clasped my hand in both of his.
"Come, I have something for you."
I dared a glance at the bedroom door. My hope chest still sat at home, filled with lace and linen and needlework, filled with the things that I had been making since I was a child, the things that women used to create a home. But that was not the gift that men expected from their wives on the day they wed. Ephraim stooped a little, so he could look me in the eye.
"Not that. You don't have to be afraid of me, Martha. I won't hurt you."
He tugged me to his chest and slid his hands into the hair at the base of my head, into the wild curls I could never tame.
"I would never hurt you. Not ever."
I pulled back to look at his face. "What is it then?"
"There."
He pointed to the long table in the kitchen, and I saw the wooden box in its center for the first time. It was made of pine, and there were no nails or dowels. He had pieced it together in tongue and groove fashion. "Only Ephraim." I placed my palm on the lid. I gestured toward the rest of the house, finished perfectly and sealed against the weather. "You had extra time on your hands, I suppose." He liked the teasing note in my voice, responded to it physically. Ephraim eased closer to me and set one gentle hand on my shoulder. I felt the weight of it, heavy and strong.
"The house was finished months ago, then the furniture a few weeks passed. A man needs something to occupy him at night."
"Indeed." I cleared my throat.
"Open it," he said. "It's all for you."
He nudged me with his forearm, and I lifted the lid on his gift. Inside was a book bound in leather, filled with blank pages, ink cakes, a feather quill, and a King James Bible. I pulled them from the box and set them on the table one by one. "What is this?"
"The beginning of your education, Mrs. Ballard."
I laughed. "You know I can't read."
"That, love, is exactly the point."
"I don't understand." His face was unreadable, and I was about to ask for an explanation when his mouth covered mine. His hands were gentle as feathers on my cheeks, thumbs stroking my jaw. His tongue brushed my lips, begged them to part, to soften. After a moment, they did. He tasted of salt and bread and apple cider. His hands never wandered from my face, but I felt the restraint it took him to keep them there. I felt the passion and the frustration in his lips. I felt the longing in every inch of his body. Ephraim Ballard kissed me for long, endless moments. He was breathing hard when he finally pulled away.
"I will not take your body tonight, Martha. I will not do it until you ask me to."
"No," he said, shaking his head.
"Not until you beg me to. I will take nothing from you that is not freely given. Do you understand?" My answer was but a ghost of speech.
"Yes."
"There is only one thing I will ask of you, as your husband."
He brought his face so close that I was certain he would kiss me again. But Ephraim only rubbed his nose against mine, brushed it back and forth until I closed my eyes.
"Let me kiss you, please, whenever I want, just like that. Will you trust me with that one thing?"
I was incapable of words, but I nodded and tilted my chin upwards. He took the offer. His hands did not drift beneath my collarbone, but they explored the base of my skull and the thick curls of my hair. He made himself acquainted with my earlobes, cheekbone, jaw, the cowlick at my temple, and his tongue went to work as well, tangling with mine and tracing the shape of my lips.
You like that, he said when he pulled away. It wasn't a question. He knew I did. Ephraim could read my face the way he read his ledgers and his books. I was open before him.
Yes.
Good then. He nodded toward the bench beside the table. Sit. He straightened the Bible on the table. Always the carpenter, he squared it with his own body, then opened it. It was new. I could tell that much. The leather binding was clean and hard with no cracks or scuffs. The first page was blank, and I, of course, could not read the second. This was no concern to Ephraim. He read it to me. Family register. He pointed first to one line, and then those below it. Husband and wife. Births, deaths. Our life will be recorded here, on this page. He pressed the book flat with his hands, and a smile spread broad across his face. The feather quill had been sharpened to a fierce point. He mixed the ink with water in a little dish and dipped the quill into the black puddle. I relaxed next to him on the bench. The small movement brought me close enough to Ephraim that our thighs and shoulders touched. Ephraim tapped the quill against the rim 3 times, knocking the excess ink off the tip. He raised it above the page. On this, the 19th day of December, in the year of our Lord, 1754, I, Ephraim Ballard, do take as wife Martha Moore. This is my name, he said, scratching the quill against the paper. This is how it's written. The letters were all angles, lines, and curves, and they made no sense to me. But it was wonderful to know that this collection of ink scratches was the name I had taken as my own. And this, he added, dipping the quill once again into the ink, is yours. I watched him write my name with a delicate hand. He couldn't have been more gentle or precise if he had been drawing my face with that quill. My name looked beautiful beneath his hand. Have you ever seen your name written before?
No.
Your father never wrote it for you?
I never asked.
I will write it for you any time you ask. I will engrave it upon my own heart if that is what you want.
He lowered his lips to my temple, brushed them against my hairline.
And I will teach you to write mine.
He rubbed his nose against my ear, my jaw, my temple. I couldn't think straight. After a moment, it was clear to him that I wasn't thinking anything at all.
Ephraim laughed, deep and warm. Well then, Mrs. Ballard, let us begin your education.
He pulled the stack of parchment closer, arranged the ink and quill. Then he flipped the Bible open to a section near the middle.
Do you know what book this is?
I shook my head. How could I?
It's one you'll never hear preached in church, and I'd wager your father never read it at the table after dinner.
What is it?
The Song of Solomon.
He traced the title with his finger, and I tried to follow along, wondering which marks corresponded to each word.
Shall I read you a little?
Please. He set his fingertip beneath each word and moved it slowly as he read.
I followed it with my eyes. The Song of Songs, which is Solomon's, he said. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for thy love is better than wine. I tried to hide my smile. He noticed before I had the chance to smooth it from my face.
Ephraim repeated the verse, but this time he spoke the words against my lips. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. Yes, I thought. I will let him.
I couldn't help but wonder if the book said anything about his tongue, because Ephraim made full use of that as well.
The Bible says that? I asked when he came up for air.
Indeed, and a great deal more.
I had not noticed before how tired he looked. Stubble along his jaw and dark circles under his eyes. Ephraim yawned.
There was only one bed in this house, and it was just barely big enough to fit the two of us. But he had taken even this into account.
He pulled me to my feet.
Come with me.
He led me to the bedroom, opened the door. He took me to stand beside the bed, held my hands in his.
I've promised not to touch you until you're ready, and I will keep that promise if it kills me. But you are my wife, Martha, and I would very much like to share your bed.
My bed?
I built it for you.
I answered him with a quick kiss.
Was that a yes?
I nodded. I prefer to be warm when I sleep.
Then allow me the honor.
Ephraim turned down the bed and left me in privacy to undress. I climbed in, wearing my shift, and expected him to join me. But he wandered through the cabin, blowing out candles. The room filled with the smell of candle smoke, and the only light came from the glowing embers in the hearth. When I heard his clothing falling to the floor, my heart exploded beneath my ribs. There was a weight in the bed beside me, a shifting of air as he lifted the blanket, and then the full length of his body was right there next to mine.
May I hold you?
He whispered. Yes.
Come here then, and let us sleep.
Ephraim pulled me to his chest and tucked his legs behind mine. If we were vertical, I would be sitting in his lap. But we were not vertical. We were lying in bed, not consummating our marriage. And yet it was the most intimate thing I had ever done. It was later, as I lay in a stubborn wakefulness, curled against Ephraim's back for warmth, listening to the slow and even pace of his breathing, that I let my mind wander to all the things we could have done in the dark that evening. I thought about what it would have been like to feel his hands along my body, what places he might have explored with the lips and tongue. I thought of a coupling that didn't involve pain or fear or violence. I thought of myself surrendering to the warm and gentle hands of the man I loved, and my skin grew warm. The desire to roll onto my back and pull him with me was so strong that I could think of nothing else. Instead, I lay there, eyes open, nose pressed against the smooth, warm skin of his back, and I let him take me in thought only. I was deep in this fantasy when I heard the deep rumble of his voice.
Does it feel good, Martha, what I'm doing to you, in your thoughts? I startled and pulled away from him.
No, he whispered, reaching back to grab my arm and drape it over his chest again. He placed my hand on his heart and set his own on top.
Don't stop. I'm certain that whatever it is you're imagining is something I'm enjoying immensely.
I thought you were asleep.
I could feel your eyelashes brushing against my back, he explained. That's how I knew you were awake. You were getting warmer by the moment.
Ephraim laughed,
and I cannot help but wonder what you were thinking about us doing in my bed.
You said it was my bed.
Ah, that it is, love. And when you are ready to have me do, indeed, what you just had me do in thought, we will find another use for your bed.
3. A blizzard. January 1790. Some rise by sin, and some by virtue fall. William Shakespeare, Measure for Measure. Fort Western, Friday, January 1. I spend the first hour of the first morning of this new decade bearing a baby. He is deadborn and small, no more than 5 pounds, and his arrival into this cruel world came well over a month early.
It seems wrong that he should go into the ground without a name, Ephraim says.
She refused to name him, just as she refused to declare the father. He shifts the small, wrapped bundle in his left arm and sets his other hand upon it.
Nathan,
he pronounces.
Ephraim,
I warn. We have no right.
And who will know?
He looks around, peers into the dark, cloud-covered sky, the forest. Then those intense blue eyes turn back to me, and I see the lantern light flickering in their depths.
Again, he says, he should not go into the ground without a name.
I am too tired to argue. My hands are blistered and bloody from digging the hole, and my back aches. Fine, then, Nathan.
The grave is deep enough now, over a foot deep and wide, but was a misery to dig, requiring both hatchet and pick. Though Ephraim offered to do it, I'd insisted he stay inside with the family. It is only by luck that he is with me now anyway. The weather turned poor last night, and he was headed to Fort Western as I left. So we'd crossed together, and he met me at the home of the laboring woman once he was done visiting with James Wall. There was nothing I could do for mother or child. The wee boy was already gone when he whooshed from his mother's body, and she, terrified and unmarried, had declared nothing, keeping the name of the father secret. She had only cried, then screamed, then started to shake. The shaking is normal. Most mothers find themselves unable to stop the trembling after giving birth. But this was different. It came from her core and continued. It was feral and unhinged, and I left the room only when she finally surrendered the tiny body, and her mother took over the vigil. Within moments, the girl fell asleep from sheer exhaustion. She is only 18. Part of my remit, a thing required of me by law to be licensed as a midwife, is to bury a child born dead, or one that passes while I am present. The requirement is meant to spare the mother this agony, but instead places the hardship directly on the shoulders of the midwife. And in winter, oh God, why must there be such a cruel season? To shovel away the snow, then hack into the frozen ground, to dig a grave deep enough that any passing wild animal will not interfere. Rocks piled atop are usually needed as well. In this case, the only possible location was beneath the boughs of a large, sprawling pine. It is the one place where the ground is almost soft enough to dig a grave. Still, it was not easy. It is now the middle of the night, and I turn to my husband, reaching for the bundle in his arms. He does not hand the baby over immediately. Instead, he looks at the tiny, wrapped linen parcel, and I see the sorrow pool in his eyes. It's time. Ephraim shakes his head, dislodging the ghosts that reside there, then gently sets the child into my arms. Together we place him in the hole, cover him first with dirt, a heaping of snow, then pine needles, and finally a stone cairn that cannot be dislodged by any wild animal. Afterward, my husband kneels beside the grave, lips moving in silent prayer. This sight is so familiar to me that I am nearly blinded by grief. Some memories never fade. He looks to my face and the tears that freeze against my cheeks. Let's go home, love, he says.
In the morning, after I've indulged myself in a rare cup of hot black coffee, I retreat to my workroom and go over the list of deliveries I have performed in the last 12 months. The year of our Lord, 1789, brought 50 new souls to Hollowell. Of those, I attended 39. The rest either were delivered by someone else or happened before I could arrive. As has been true every year since I began my inventory, the majority of babies I delivered were girls, 27 last year. I do not consider myself a superstitious woman, but I find comfort in these numbers. Every midwife I have ever known has cautioned that an abundance of male births for multiple years in a row means looming war. One of them, old, bitter, and widowed, had buried every child of her own, and in the calcification of her grief would refer to such boys as the cannon fodder of kings. I have never delivered a boy, either from my body or with my hands, and not thought of those words. Of my own 9 children, 6 were girls, and I have always taken this as a good omen. It makes me hopeful that the wars of this country are behind us. 4 of the births in the Hook last year were stillborn, though I attended only 3 of them. Each is a bitter loss, and I take my time reading the entries. Thursday, February 25th. Birth. Mr. Jacob Chandler's daughter. Mrs. Chandler was delivered at the 9th hour of a girl. Deadborn. Thursday, September 10. Birth. Mr. Pinkham's daughter. Clear. I was called to see Captain Pinkham's wife. I left home at the 12th hour, walked. My patient was delivered of a daughter at the 9th hour in the evening. It was deadborn. I tarried all night. Thursday, December 17. Birth. Mr. Stone's daughter. Clarissa Stone was delivered of a dead daughter at the 12th hour yesterday. The operation performed by Dr. Benjamin Page. The infant's limbs were much dislocated, as I am informed. The man knows not how to deliver a breech presentation. 6 days after he gave Grace Sewell a near-lethal dose of laudanum, Clarissa Stone called for that idiot doctor to deliver her child. The results were disastrous. And yes, I understand why she did not want me in attendance after the tongue lashing I gave her and Coleman's, but there was no reason to go to Dr. Page. I am but one of 5 midwives in this county. He is 24 years old. 24! I have 30 years on the man, and well over twice as much life experience. Yet the young mothers of this town are dazzled by the mere idea of a Harvard-educated man. So much so that they put the lives of their unborn children in his hands, and the results are deadly. It is not that every birth I attend goes well, of course. Last night's delivery is proof of that. But she had lost the child before I ever arrived, and that is the difference between Paige and me. With a heavy heart, I lift pen to paper and record the life lost yesterday. Thursday, December 31. Birth. Ruth Emery's son. Clear and very cold. I was called to see Ruth Emery, delivered her of a son that was dead. It was her firstborn. She continues in grief. I left her at midnight. Mr. Ballard conducted me there and home again, as the roads are near unpassable. I consider them my babies. I am not their mother, of course, but they are mine, and I can still feel the weight of grief hanging heavy in those birthing rooms. The only thing harder than losing an infant would be losing a mother, and I thank the great gift of Providence that I have yet to experience this myself. Sometimes, however, the most difficult part of a birth is simply getting myself there in time. The river, as always, is my greatest obstacle. Frozen or free, it must often be crossed. And whether by ferry or foot, there is no safe way to do so. The weather, too, acts as villain against me more often than I think is fair. Together, these two forces make as much trouble for me as the patients themselves. Earlier this spring, I faced such a circumstance, and I flip back in my journal to the entry. Saturday, April 6, birth. Eben Hewen's daughter. A severe storm of rain. I was called at the first hour by Eben Hewen. We crossed the river in his boat. It was a great sea a-going. We got safe over, then set out for Mr. Hewen's. I crossed the stream near his home on fleeting logs, but made it safely. But as we passed by Mr. Haynes's, a large tree blew up by the roots before me, which caused my horse to spring back, which spared my life. I was assisted over the fallen tree by Mr. Haynes. Went on and soon came to another stream, but the bridge was gone. Mr. Hewen took the reins, waded through, and led my horse to the other side. We arrived safe and unhurt. Mrs. Hewen, safe delivered at 10 that evening. Last year, two of the children I delivered were illegitimate, but only one mother declared the father while in travail. She has since wed, but poor Sarah White remains unmarried and much maligned. Sunday, June 21, birth. Sarah White's daughter. Clear morn. Yesterday I was called at the rising of the sun to Sarah White, she being in travail and is yet unmarried. She remained ill through the day but was delivered safe of a daughter at the 9th hour this morning. Today it is not just the births that I take time to note. I also go back in search of 3 entries, noted by an ink blot in the margin. Keeping with tradition, I do not move on in my survey of the previous year before paying tribute. This time, however, I mark an important and grievous anniversary. Saturday, June 26. My daughter, Trafine, died 20 years ago today. She was 4 years old. Sunday, July 4. My daughter, Dorothy, died 20 years ago today. She was 2 years old. Thursday, July 7. My daughter, Martha, died 20 years ago today. She was 8 years old. Of everything that I have suffered in my 54 years, these 3 scars are etched deepest in my soul. It does not matter that I had 2 more daughters after bearing those 3. The loss is still as fresh and painful as though it happened yesterday. When they died, generations died with them. I leave my desk for a moment and go to the wooden box on my work table. I pull out the Bible that Ephraim gave me on our wedding night so many years ago. On the family register beneath our names is the list he promised we would make together, our own legacy, recorded in black and white. I run my finger down the birth dates of our 9 children. Cyrus Ballard, September 11, 1756. Lucy Ballard, August 28, 1758. Martha Ballard, April 7, 1761. Died July 7, 1769. Jonathan Ballard, March 4, 1763. Trafine Ballard, March 26, 1765. Died June 26, 1769. Dorothy Ballard, May 17, 1767. Died July 4, 1769. Hannah Ballard, August 6, 1769. Dorothy Dolly Ballard, February 20, 1772. Ephraim Ballard Jr., March 30, 1778. For 23 years, my primary work was to grow a family. Work I considered both honor and duty, joy and trial. The fact that I am only 54 and have buried 1/3 of that family is a sorrow for which there are no words. I was 8 months pregnant with Hannah that awful summer, and in my darkest moments was convinced that the ache of it would put me and the child I carried in the ground as well. Rarely does a day go by that I do not look at Hannah and think her a miracle. It hurts. Every year it hurts when I do this. But to forget would be the greater injury. Now that it is done, however, I push my book away and breathe long and deep through my nose. I listen to my daughters rattling around the kitchen, smell the hiss of bacon and the sizzle of potatoes. I put away my journal and my Bible and go to be with the children I still have left. Ballard's Mill, Sunday, January 3. My family stopped attending public worship in July when Isaac Foster was removed as preacher. It was our only available forum of protest. And while I do not regret the decision, it does feel strange to sit at home on a Sunday morning, but it is not unpleasant to rest before the fire, a warm cup of tea in hand, and read the Book of Common Prayer. He has shown the strength of his arm, I whisper, the nail of my right index finger running along the last verse of today's liturgy. He has cast down the mighty from their thrones and has lifted up the lowly. I close my eyes, pray that it might be so, and close the book. No sooner have I set it back on the shelf than I hear a gentle knock at the door. Hannah sticks her head outside, then looks back at me and says, "Mistress Parker is here."
Is her husband with her? I haven't seen Seth since the morning he and the others cut Joshua Burgess from the ice. He'd been one of the first to flee during my inspection of the body.
Hannah shakes her head. She's alone.
Didn't you invite her in?
She asked to speak with you at the gate.
Is she ill?
Hannah shrugs. Not to look at.
Strange, I think, and pull my shawl off the peg, wondering at this need for privacy as I slip out the door.
Mrs. Parker stands inside the garden gate, wringing her hands.
Ellen!
I look her over, head to foot.
Are you unwell?
In a manner of speaking.
There is no wind, and the snow has a thin crust of ice on top, where it has melted during the day and frozen again at night. My boots make an unpleasant crunching noise as I move across the yard.
What's wrong? I ask.
I need to borrow a horse.
I know for a fact that her husband has two fine steeds tied up in their barn.
Why?
Ellen Parker is a shy woman, the kind who drifts to the back of a crowded room, who blushes whenever too many people look at her at once. The cold has turned the tip of her nose red, but I think that the pink tinge on her cheeks is embarrassment.
She's back,
Ellen whispers.
Who?
Her. Ellen's eyes widen, and she purses her lips as though this should be obvious.
The Negro woman. I need to see her.
Oh. I heard her husband, Seth, mention this at the tavern when I inspected Joshua Burgess a month ago, but I'd forgotten in all the turmoil that followed.
Do you not want your husband to know?
Seth wouldn't approve. And if I take one of your horses, he'll not ask where I've gone.
Where does he think you are now?
Here, with you. He saw me walk off, and he'll see me walk home.
I'm not lying.
Not much, at least,
she whispers.
Under different circumstances, I might point out that a lie of omission is no different from any other kind, but I have no issue with lending her the horse.
You can take Bucket. He's old and slow, but he'll get you there.
Thank you. I only need him for a few hours.
Of course. But it's a hard ride through the woods. Are you sure there isn't something I can do for you here?
Yes, she says, without explanation. I'll send young Ephraim to the barn then.
Ellen thanks me again, and I go to find my son and give him instructions for the horse. 10 minutes later, I stand at the door and watch my neighbor ride away, not down the lane and toward the main road, but into the north pasture, toward the path that winds 3 miles through the woods to Burnt Hill. 4 times a year, a Negro woman, known only as Doctor, comes to Hollowell. She arrives unannounced and might remain for a single week or months on end. No one ever knows. But her arrival is always whispered about, and the news spreads from house to house like a fine mist drifting beneath the door. Doctor is one of the only people I know whose medical expertise exceeds my own. Some have argued that she has the gift of healing. Others, of course, Seth Parker among them, call her a witch. It's an unimaginative accusation, and one that I am frankly tired of hearing. Witchcraft, as though there is no other explanation for a woman who excels at her work. Doctor speaks with a warm French accent and often describes herself as an accoucheuse, a midwife, same as me. Yet she is so much more. Doctor is a mystery to many in the Hook, and therefore they fear her. Yet I've never seen anyone who does not watch the woman with a kind of bewildered awe. As of last week,
There are 1,199 residents in Hollowell. Families number 184. And of those, 12 are black. All free. There are no slaves in Hollowell, the Supreme Judicial Court having effectively abolished the practice in Massachusetts 9 years ago by their ruling in the Mum Bett case. The census counts everyone in the hook except Doctor, because she has asked those who live here to make sure the census takers don't know she moves among us. Doctor has sworn never to return should her presence be revealed, and we are more than happy to keep her secret, given how many of us rely on her services. When I can no longer hear Bucket snort and stomp through the woods, I return inside and go to my workroom. I mix the ink and dip my pen. Sunday, January 3. Clear. I have been at home. Mrs. Parker borrowed our horse to go and see the Negro woman doctor. Burnt Hill. Wednesday, January 6. I approach the cabin slowly. For much of the year, the logger's base at the foot of Burnt Hill remains empty. In spring, men come up from Winthrop and Pittston to camp and harvest timber that they later send down a heavily swollen Bracket Brook toward Hollowell, where it's bundled at the Kennebec and ferried south in rafts. But in winter, the brook fades to a trickle, and the remote camp is abandoned. The tallest point in three counties, Burnt Hill, so named for a decades-old fire, is windswept and bitterly cold, barren at its rounded peak, except for brush and rocks. Its slopes are thick with a canopy of aging paper birch and sugar maple. As they're cut from the hillside, one by one, trembling aspen, balsam, and spruce rise to take their place. It is the aspen that I like best, however, not just for their pale, speckled bark and astonishing show of gold each fall, but because every aspen in this great expanse of forest is connected by a single root system. They give life, one to another, and work to replace what the loggers take. There is much that men could learn from nature if we would only listen. Beautiful though Burnt Hill might be, the only reason anyone would make the trek out to this place in the dead of winter is to see Doctor. Knowledge of her arrival is passed up and down the Kennebec in muted whispers, but she is only visited by those who strive to keep their secrets close. As I ride into the clearing, a young Wabanaki family slips out the cabin door, a man and a woman holding an infant swaddled in rabbit pelts. Both parents are draped in heavy wool blankets, dyed a deep and startling red, and they wear the traditional leggings, tunics, and deerskin moccasins. The woman cradles her child close to her body and keeps her eyes on the ground, careful of each treacherous step through the snowdrifts. But the father looks to me and nods cautiously before taking the child, then helping his wife onto the horse. Once she is situated, he lifts the bundle to her again, then leads them from the clearing without a backward glance. Theirs are the only tracks in the 2 inches of fresh snow that blankets the clearing. Fascinated, I wait until that flash of crimson is no longer visible between the pine boughs before I approach the cabin. In total, it is no bigger than my workroom, and sits like a lopsided rectangle at the base of a small stone outcropping. Smoke curls from the chimney, and I can hear humming within, a melodic rise and fall of voice that sounds both familiar and foreign. I dismount Brutus and tie him to the side of a large covered wagon that sits beside the cabin. Behind it and to the side is a lean-to stable, built by loggers and made from hewn, lashed timber. It rests against the rock face and is wide enough for only a single steed. Inside is the largest horse I have ever seen. 18 hands if he's an inch, and so ruddy he gleams like fire in the shadows. Brutus snorts at him, and he returns the gesture while I shake my head. "It's always a pissing contest with you men," I say.
then turned to the other horse.
And who are you?
If I have a weakness for anything in this world, it is a big, beautiful stallion.
He is Goliath, a voice calls out from inside the cabin. And you, Martha Ballard, should come inside. C'est froid.
It is cold, and I am grateful for the welcome. But I remember at the last second that I have brought a gift, and I go to retrieve the bottle from my saddlebag first. It is a bottle of syrup of currants and brandy, wrapped in a soft linen cloth and tied with a ribbon. I do not need doctor's services today, not in the usual sense at least, but I have not forgotten to bring payment.
Good to see you again, doctor, I say, as I step inside and shrug out of my riding cloak. I hang it on a peg and brush the snow from my hair, then close the door to shut out the cold that has drifted in after me like a fog.
How did you know it was me? Doctor offers a knowing smile, full lips curving around small straight teeth.
Oh, I say, as the answer occurs to me, you recognize my voice.
You would recognize mine, no?
Indeed.
There is a rocking chair on either side of the fireplace and a flat, round stump between them with a lantern on top that emanates a soft golden light. Roughly a decade younger than me, Doctor has high cheekbones and a long, slender neck. She wears a green muslin dress, and her hair is kept up and away beneath a matching head wrap. There is a mortar in her lap and a pestle in her hand. Beside her is a woven basket, lid fitted tightly on top. No doubt a gift from the Wabanaki for services rendered. Doctor sees me looking at the basket and says,
The woman you saw outside has gone dry. She has nothing left to feed le bébé.
I take this as my invitation to come in and sit down. As I arrange my skirts, she continues,
It happens. No one knows why. But le bébé has not weaned. So they came to me for help.
Are there none in her tribe who can nurse the child for her?
None with milk to spare.
She looks at me as though I ought to know this.
It is winter, and many are hungry.
What did you tell her? Doctor flexes the hand that has been working the pestle. Her fingers are long and thin, elegant, but I can see that the pinky on that hand was once broken and healed poorly. It does not fully straighten like the others.
There is nothing so good as mother's milk, but feeding the child boiled walnuts, mixed with cornmeal and water, will get him to the spring when he can eat other foods.
I did not know this, and I tell her so. She looks me up and down and says,
You are not ill?
No.
Tell me why you are here, then.
I place the bottle of syrup beside the lantern. Ellen Parker borrowed my horse this week to come see you.
And you are curious? Why?
No, I have enough secrets to carry. I've little interest in adding hers to the pile.
And yet you didn't come to visit.
Doctor turns her gaze back to the mortar and pestle. She cups the rounded knob in her palm and rolls it in a counterclockwise motion against the mortar, crushing the fine, dry leaves into powder. It smells of black pepper and sage.
Why shouldn't I? No one does. There is always a reason.
What about Hitty? Doctor looks up at me sharply, dark eyes still and steady as a lake at midnight.
Not even air, she says. Not since she took up with Setom.
I thought they were married.
Only, what is the world?
She laces her fingers together and holds them up. Hand fast?
Yes. Not that it matters. No law recognizes a marriage, handfast or otherwise, between your kind and mine.
Doctor licks the end of her broken pinky
and sets it to the fine powder in her bowl. She tastes it, thinking for a moment, with eyes closed, then nods once, deciding it's the way she wants it, and sets the bowl on the floor beside her.
But again, you didn't come to talk about my daughter.
No. Tell me, Zen. There are so many things about Doctor that I don't understand. Where she comes from and where she goes when she isn't in Hollowell. How she learned the craft of medicine and from whom. When she learned to speak English and how she became acquainted with the Wabanaki. How she travels so freely on her own as a woman in the wild. But if I could ask Doctor any question and be guaranteed an answer, I would ask her name. What is it? Yet that is forbidden knowledge, a question that will have me immediately dismissed. So I ask what I came here to learn. What do you know about the herbs tansy and savin? Doctor answers without hesitation.
They are used to stop a child from growing in the womb. One brings les règles.
She sets a hand, fingers spread, on her lower abdomen, then clenches it into a fist.
And the other? Cramping. But you already knew that, no?
I tended a woman recently, Rebecca Foster, who took them together. A great deal from what I can gather. But she didn't lose the child.
The baby wasn't welcome.
It was forced upon her. It isn't so much that Doctor winces, but a shadow flickers through her dark velvet eyes. Briefly, just the ghost of an emotion, gone as quickly as it came.
So she wants to try les herbes again?
No, or at least she hasn't said so, and I wouldn't recommend it anyway. I didn't give them to her in the first place.
Bon, Savin is wicked. Kills a woman as often as it helps.
But will it cause harm to the child afterward, since it failed to unroot? That is what I need to know. The idea of Rebecca Foster being left not just with an unwanted baby, but with an invalid, has made me lose more than one night's sleep.
No more than the mother? Is she bien?
I fear she'll never be well. I tap my chest with one finger. In here. Then I move that finger to my temple and tap again. Or here.
You are worried she will hurt le bébé when it comes? Or herself?
I am worried about 10,000 things. Doctor laughs, a deep and rich timbre that fills the cabin.
Then you haven't learned much about being a healer.
She sees the look of hurt cross my face, but doesn't chase it with an apology.
Have you done all you can to help this woman?
Yes.
Worry only about the care you give when called upon. The rest is not yours to fret about.
Ah, Doctor says, holding up one finger.
Someone is coming.
Who?
My next patient.
I turn to the door and listen. At first, I hear nothing but pine boughs creaking in the wind and the siskins who live deep within their branches calling to one another. But then, after a few long seconds, I detect the steady clomp of hooves making their way across the clearing.
Who gave Madame Foster les herbes if it was not you?
I glance at the woven basket beside her. I believe it was the Wabanaki, though I cannot be sure. They have long been friends.
Ah, that is why she did not die. As to why the child stayed rooted, you must ask them. I have yet to see the Wabanaki make a mistake with les herbes.
Doctor remains in her chair, hands folded in her lap. She nods once. I have been dismissed. Thank you, I say, rising. Doctor smiles.
For what?
Reminding me that I am not God. Again, that laugh, like water over rocks.
Had you forgotten?
No, only that there are some hurts I will never be skilled enough to heal.
Inscrutable as always, Doctor only stares as I go to the door. I slide into my riding cloak and pull on my gloves. We are not friends, not in the traditional sense. I would like it to be so, but I can sense the wall between us, a barrier impervious to my admiration. Perhaps one day I will win her over. A knock sounds on the door. Doctor looks at me, but speaks to this new arrival.
Entrez,
she says. I feel the cold air on my neck, feel the sudden gaze of a startled stranger, and when I turn, I find May Dawin standing at the door.
I'm sorry, don't worry, I'm just leaving, I tell her.
And then, because I do not want the girl to feel awkward for bypassing me in favor of Doctor, I add,
how is Sam?
It is no surprise whatsoever that Sam Dawin fell head first in love with the girl. Apart from the fact that large men often have a penchant for tiny women, a long-standing irritation of mine, she is lovely, like a doe, all soft browns, hair, freckles, eyes, and smooth skin. Her voice, too, has a gentle, soothing cadence.
He is well, Mr. Spallard, she says. Thank you for mending him. I don't know what I would have...
Her voice thickens with emotion.
What I would do without him.
I set my hand on May's shoulder and give her a pat. He loves you too. Never doubt that.
I couldn't, not if I tried.
Good day, both of you, I say, and step out the door. As it closes behind me, I hear May introduce herself, and then comes the usual response.
You may call me Doctor.
May Dawin is inside, whispering with Doctor. But Sam stands beside the wagon, running his big hand up and down the bridge of Brutus's long, soft nose. He has never looked less pleased to see me.